of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is nothing if not a political survivor. A polarizing figure both in Israel and the United States, later this year he's set to become the longest-serving prime minister in Israel's history. To hit that mark, Netanyahu and his center-right Likud party will have to do well in elections next month. Right now, polls show he's in a close race with an opposition grouping of centrist parties called Blue and White, led by a former army chief of staff named Benny Gantz. But Netanyahu isn't just fighting for his political life, he's also fighting for his freedom. That's because Israel's attorney general has moved to indict him in three separate cases on charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. So on this edition of Global Journalist, a look at Israel's upcoming elections and the legacy of Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel, the Palestinian territories, and the broader Middle East. Is this his last stand? In a few minutes, we'll bring in some guests who have been following the campaign and Netanyahu's career closely. But first, we're joined by Daniel Astrin. He's a correspondent in Jerusalem for NPR News. Daniel, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Benjamin Netanyahu has been prime minister since 2009. He was also prime minister from 1996 to 1999. He's really been this dominant political figure in Israel for decades now. Is this upcoming election, is it kind of just a referendum on him?
It is. I think these elections really are about that one central question. Should Benjamin Netanyahu stay or go? Should he continue to serve as the prime minister? As you said, he is a very divisive person in Israeli politics, probably the most divisive. The people who despise him in Israel say he is eroding Israeli democracy with rhetoric against Israel's Arab citizens, with attacks on the media, attacks on justice officials. They say he's at fault for not advancing peace efforts with the Palestinians. But his supporters see him as an unparalleled world statesman with excellent English, with ties with world leaders like Trump, and as Israel's best defender, a hawk keeping Israel safe from its enemies. And so when Netanyahu called early elections several months ago, it was looking like he would win easily, but now he faces several challenges, this new political party that poses a real possibility of beating him, and these corruption allegations that he faces.
Yeah, so I just wanted to follow up with you on these corruption allegations against him. Just recap for us what exactly he's facing.
Well, last month, the attorney general here announced he was considering corruption charges, criminal charges, including bribery. And there are three separate cases, and they all involve Netanyahu's relationships with businessmen. The first case is a case involving a Hollywood producer, an Israeli who was the producer of Little Women, among other films. And the attorney general alleges that Netanyahu did favors for him, pressing for tax benefits for him in Israel, and other favors, and in exchange received a supply of gifts like champagne and cigars. The other two cases have to do with Netanyahu's relationship with the media. The attorney general says Netanyahu is suspected of discussing a potential deal with a major newspaper publisher to help him undercut a competitor in exchange for positive press. And then the most serious allegation that Netanyahu is facing is that he used his authorities to approve a company merger for a telecom businessman. That was a very lucrative deal for that businessman. In exchange, that businessman's news website gave Netanyahu and his family very favorable press coverage. So Netanyahu is now facing these allegations. He gets the chance in court to fight them and to convince the attorney general not to press charges. But it does look like an indictment is inevitable.
Well, what about the timing of this? Isn't it odd for the attorney general to be making these announcements just before an election? In the U.S., the Justice Department actually has guidelines about not filing indictments against public officials within, I think it's 60 days of an election, so as not to influence the poll.
Well, yes. First of all, technically, the charges have not been filed. The attorney general has announced his interest in possibly filing charges pending a hearing that Netanyahu gets. But certainly Netanyahu says this is election interference. His critics are saying that Netanyahu knew that these possible charges were coming. The police months and months ago, several months ago, already announced that they were recommending to the attorney general to file charges against him. And so the thinking here, according to many analysts, is that, well, perhaps Netanyahu wanted to call these early elections because he wanted to try to preempt the attorney general. And he was hoping that the attorney general would either wouldn't have time to come to his conclusions before the elections, or to convince the attorney general that if he does win a fresh mandate from the public, not to pursue these charges.
So how is this playing out in the campaign? How has he responded to these charges?
Well, they've really been a central issue now in Netanyahu's campaign. When he gave a speech right after the attorney general made this announcement, he spoke with a lot of terms that you might be familiar with from Trump. He called these allegations fake over and over. He called it a blood libel, scandalous lies, a witch hunt. And he's blaming the media and the left wing in Israel for trying to conspire and to pressure the attorney general to file these charges. And he says, it's not about me, it's about my right-wing government and attempts to topple my government.
So it sounds like there are very clear echoes to how President Trump has responded to the Mueller investigation in the United States and some of the other investigations of him and his campaign.
I think so. And you see this kind of this as one journalist called it, a feedback loop between Trump and Netanyahu. In Netanyahu's campaign, he has a big billboard that's out that shows him and Trump standing together, showing that trying to highlight Netanyahu's statesmanship and his close ties with Trump.
Well, have these affected his poll numbers? Like, how has this moved the public?
So that's the really interesting question, because it seems that the majority of the Israeli public has already made up their mind about Netanyahu, and there are those who can't stand him and won't want to vote for him, and there are those who are his base and his supporters, and that these corruption allegations are not going to change their mind. But because these elections appear to be so close, it could be a matter of very few votes tipping the scales either way. And so these corruption allegations could, at least this is what Netanyahu is concerned about, that maybe some of his supporters who would have voted for him might be convinced to vote for the opposition.
Well, Daniel Estrin, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
You're welcome.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about elections next month in Israel, where Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in a tough race for re-election as he battles three separate corruption investigations. We just spoke with NPR's Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem. For more on this issue, we're joined by three other guests. With us in Tel Aviv is Emmanuel Navon. He teaches international relations at Tel Aviv University and is a senior fellow at the Kohelet Policy Forum, an Israeli think tank. He's also a senior analyst on Israel's I-24 News. Emmanuel, welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us from Jerusalem is Aaron Heller. He's an Israel correspondent for the Associated Press. Aaron, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And on the line from Washington, D.C. is Dan Arbel. He was a long-serving diplomat in Israel's Foreign Service, including 3 years as its deputy chief of mission at its embassy in Washington, D.C. He's now a scholar in residence at American University. Dan, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, Emmanuel Navon, if I could start with you, give us just a brief primer on Israel's electoral system, because in Israel's parliament, the Knesset, there's more than a dozen different parties there. And so it sounds like even the biggest parties can only sort of reasonably expect to win maybe a quarter of the seats on their own.
Right. So Israel is a multi-party parliamentary system, actually pretty similar to most European countries. It's not a first-past-the-post system like in America. Most parties get represented in the Knesset, and you can't really have a government with only one party. You always end up having a coalition with generally about four or five, sometimes six political parties. And what that means is that in order to win an election, you need to have a majority. So it's not enough to be the biggest party in the Knesset. You need to actually have behind you enough parties that are going to support you and recommend you as a prime minister to the president. So there was a precedent, for example, in the 2009 elections, when the Kadima political party, led at the time by Tzipi Livni, had one extra seat ahead of Likud. So on paper, it looked like Kadima had won the elections, but of course, it didn't, because it did not have enough political parties to support it for a coalition. So even though Likud was behind Kadima with one seat, it did have a majority required to form a government. So this is also something what's happening. It's similar with the current election. According to the polls, this new political party, Blue and White, led by Benny Gantz, is ahead of Likud, according to most polls, between 3 and 4, sometimes 5 seats. But if you look at the same polls, it does not seem to have a coalition. So it might be ahead of Likud, but it doesn't mean that it would be able to form a government.
And that's because Blue and White's allied parties aren't doing as well as Likud's allied parties then, and so therefore Blue and White can't form the majority it needs to form a government.
That's right. I mean, technically on paper, Blue and White could form a coalition with the ultra-Orthodox religious parties. There were cases in the past sometimes where those parties joined a coalition with the Labour Party, for example, in 1993. But this looks very unlikely today, because the religious parties, the Orthodox parties, in recent years have moved to the right, and they already said that they support Netanyahu. Besides, the Blue and White Party is led by Benny Gantz, but it's also an alliance with the party of Yair Lapid, whose very secular and secularist agenda is an anathema to the Orthodox parties, and they already said they wouldn't join a coalition with them.
Well, Emmanuel, if I could just stop you there, because I want to bring in Aaron Heller here. If I could just back up for a moment, we talked a little bit about Benny Gantz, the opposition leader from the Blue and White Party. What do we know about his background? What has his strategy been in this election?
Well, on paper, Benny Gantz is the perfect candidate for prime minister in Israel. He's a former military chief. He has the credentials. He's got the looks. He's very statesmanly. He is sort of the successor, if you will, to the, you know, diplomat, statesman, warrior of the past, in the mold of Yitzhak Rabin and Ehud Barak. But Israel's changed a lot since those days. And so Benny Gantz now, he is after a lot of coalition making, a lot of deals. He's heading this blue and white coalition of three basic parties, which, if you look at really at the details of who makes them up, it really spreads across the gamut of the Israeli political system. And you really see people in that same party who go from far right to far left. And the one binding thing together for them is that everybody wants to take down Netanyahu. So Gantz has been appointed the person to lead that camp. If he does get elected, it will be a rotation leadership with Yair Lapid, who's his number two. But Gantz is the face of that campaign right now. And he's the guy they're trying to put forward as sort of like a symbol of returning to the so-called good old Israel. He doesn't have the baggage. He doesn't have, you know, history. He doesn't have the corruption. He's a fresh face in politics. And so he's generated a lot of interest. The big thing against him has been that his positions have been quite vague because he was in uniform for so long. His policies aren't exactly clear. And so the big question mark is what kind of policies he would lead if he were elected. And the bigger question, of course, is whether even this vast coalition could take down Netanyahu after 10 years in power.
Well, Dan Arbel, if I could move this to you then, one of Netanyahu's winning strategies over the year has been to assure Israeli voters about a national security, and he's run as sort of the candidate that says, I can keep you safe. Is that how he's running the campaign again this year, and will that work?
Absolutely. He's running as Mr. Security, and for the first time in a very long time, he's facing the blue and white coalition, which together, there are three chiefs of staff, three former chiefs of staff of the IDF, which their slogan is that they together comprise of 117 years of security experience. So he needs to outdo them in order to prove that he's Mr. Security. And because he's prime minister, he's got, you know, more control of the agenda and able to dictate, you know, the national daily agenda. And so you see him more aggressive vis-a-vis Hamas in the south. You see him come out with exposing, different actions of Hezbollah or the IRGC, the Iranian forces, which are in Syria. So definitely he's trying to project, build on his national security image and show that he indeed is still Mr. Security, and he's got all these actions that are supporting that, both in military actions and diplomacy. And he's getting ready to come to Washington in about 10 days for the AIPAC conference and for meetings with President Trump. And there, I can assure you that you're going to see a lot of fanfare, a lot of a red carpet reception, also trying to show the strong bond between him and President Trump and the United States, all that in an effort to help his campaign and, again, show that there is no person that can actually succeed him or fill his big shoes.
And Emmanuel Navon, if I could bring you back in, Dan Arbell was talking about Prime Minister Netanyahu's planned visit to the United States. It does seem like he and President Trump have enjoyed a particularly close relationship over the past couple of years. In many countries, this would be a political anchor for many candidates. It sounds like that's not the case in Israel.
Right. Israel is not France, and Israel is not the UK. I would say that for most Israelis, the style of President Trump, from his tweets to his very divisive personality and statements, are not really an issue, because as far as most Israelis are concerned, the fact that President Trump honored his campaign commitment to transfer the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, the fact that he pulled out from the Iranian deal, which most the nuclear deal, which most Israelis opposed, that is good enough for a majority of Israelis. So what makes Trump very unpopular in, let's say, most European countries and among the Democrats in the United States is not really an issue, I would say, for most Israelis, and therefore Netanyahu does not take any political risk by showing himself as Trump a couple of weeks before the general election in Israel. If anything, it's the opposite for Netanyahu's voters. Trump is a popular figure in Israel.
A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about elections in Israel next month and the political legacy of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. We're joined by Emmanuel Navon of Tel Aviv University, Aaron Heller of the Associated Press, and Dan Arbell, a former Israeli diplomat, now at American University. If you're interested in more Global Journalists, check us out online at globaljournalist.org. There you can find our archives and additional coverage of underreported international news and human rights issues. You can also like us on Facebook, where we live stream, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, or see our videocast on YouTube. Aaron Heller, if I could bring you back into the conversation. Israel does appear to be an intensely polarized country politically. One of the big fault lines is over the role of Judaism and the state. And Prime Minister Netanyahu said recently that Israel is a nation state of Jewish people and them alone. And that raises obvious questions for Israel's Arab citizens and how they belong. How is that message resonating in Israel right now?
Well, it's been one of the major divisive issues in this election. I mean, on the face of it, it shouldn't be a divisive issue. It should be straightforward. I mean, Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people. But Netanyahu and his coalition have made it an issue in their last term now, because they've passed this law, which is sort of enshrining it in law. And what sometimes was sort of accepted to be sort of like the default status of Israel, where it's a Jewish majority, this legislation really put the 20% Arab minority a bit in a corner, feeling that they've been pushed down as far as their status is concerned. And this, of course, was a move that Netanyahu needed to do to fortify his base, but it's now being used in the election campaign. And we see that for Netanyahu, this has turned out to be actually a pretty effective strategy for him to galvanize his base. I mean, he knows that the Arabs are not going to vote for him. And so a lot of his hardline nationalistic base likes these kind of things, and they're trying to press forward with all of these kind of measures to put forward more of a nationalistic stance, and basically trying to turn to the opposition or anybody who's against him to being on the other side, which is why I guess the word left has become a bit of an insult in this election campaign. Anybody who really has not towed the line that Netanyahu has set in the last few years, he derides as a leftist, and that will include the media, will include the prosecution, the courts, and primarily also the Arab segment of Israel, which do feel that even though they have equal rights under law, they do feel sidelined. And in this election, we see that now they are trying to galvanize that in their base as well. I mean, the last elections were very famous with Netanyahu saying that, warning that Arabs were coming out in droves to the ballots. And we see that their campaign this time, some of the Arab things, is telling their supporters, actually do come out in droves. We need you to vote for us to give us more power.
Well, Dan Arbel, you've lived in the United States for a long time. Pick up on this theme as well about the issue of Jewish identity in politics in Israel, because it also seems to be a fault line between many American Jews and the Israeli government or Jewish leaders in Israel. After the massacre several months ago at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, a number of Israel's leading Orthodox rabbis refused to refer to the Tree of Life as a synagogue. And I think a lot of people took that to imply that the people there weren't really Jews or weren't Jewish enough. And we saw that in some Israeli media as well. I mean, do you see that divide continuing to grow in the coming years, or is that moving towards reconciliation?
It is absolutely, Jason. It is growing. And it has to do both with religious affairs and also national affairs. It's religious affairs is... The majority of the American Jewish community is the affiliated American Jewish community are in the conservative and reform movement, while Israel is controlled by the Orthodox rabbinical establishment, which does not recognize Reform Judaism or conservative Judaism. And we have this latest brawl between women who want to pray at the Western Wall, the holiest place for Jews, and very much vehemently opposed by the rabbinical Orthodox establishment, as we've just seen, which obviously alienates the American Jewish community, those who are conservative and reform. In addition to that, we now have in the election competing a racist party called the Jewish Power, Otzma Yehudit. By the way, Netanyahu was behind bringing them in into a coalition of parties. And that further threatens to alienate American Jews who are mostly liberal, who are mostly supporters of the U.S. Democratic Party. So that adds another element to it. Of course...
Well, Dan, if I could just stop you, remind us what it is that Otzma Yehudit, this party that you say is racist, what is it that they've said and done in the past that has led to this sort of widespread referral to them as being a racist party that's now allied with Netanyahu?
They're the successors of the Kahana Chai movement, of the late rabbi, or so-called rabbi, Meir Kahana, who called for the transfer of Arabs from the state of Israel, who called for, who advocated for a very racist policy and very anti-Arab policy. And so, against intermarriage between Jews and non-Jews and so on and so forth, but in a very, very aggressive way. And this Otzma Yehudit party is a successor of the Kahana party. And again, having that party compete and perhaps even with a good shot at getting into the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, next month is very upsetting, not only to a lot of Israelis, but to many, many American Jews. And that we should keep our eye on it, because I think that threatens to even increase or to widen the gap between Israeli Jews and the American Jewish community.
Well, Emmanuel Navon, if I could bring this back to you then, one thing that Dan had been mentioning is that there has been this sort of total collapse of the political left in Israel. Earlier in the show, we mentioned Tzipi Livni. She was once a minister in one of Netanyahu's cabinets. She ended up quitting politics earlier this year, saying that peace had become a dirty word in Israel. What sort of happened to the left in Israel, the side that used to be very much pro two-state solution, establishment of a Palestinian state?
Well, what happened basically is that the Israeli left became very identified with the Oslo agreements of 1993 and 1995 under the leadership of Yitzhak Rabin and later on of Ehud Barak. And when the Oslo process collapsed after the Camp David conference in July 2000 and the outbreak of the Second Intifada, I would say that the Israeli left never recovered from this failure, having been so identified with this political process that crashed and failed in 2000. And to most Israelis, this is, I think, the main reason why they have not been voting again or giving major support to left-wing or center-left parties, even when there was a time, for example, in 2006, when the Kadima party that was originally founded by Ariel Sharon did win a majority under the leadership of Ehud Olmert and was able to form a government. And here again, Olmert went very far in his peace offers towards Mahmoud Abbas, and his offer was not accepted. So the conclusion is that most Israelis have become very skeptical vis-a-vis the theory that a two-state solution is possible, even though the paradox here is that most Israelis do support a two-state solution, but on the other hand, they don't believe that it is feasible in the near future. And the bottom line is that the Israeli left never recovered politically from the failure of the Oslo agreements.
Well, Aaron Heller, let me throw that to you then, because Emmanuel Navon, he mentioned this sort of interesting dissonance that polls show in Israel, where most people support a two-state solution where the Palestinians would have their own free and independent state, but strong majorities also show that they don't think that's feasible or possible. Explain to us how that plays out in the campaign. Is this really an issue for people?
It is true. I mean, let's separate into two things. First of all, it's not an issue, but that's really a continuation of what Emmanuel just said. I mean, this sort of, in many ways, that dichotomy between people not believing it's possible, but yet wanting it to happen, really isn't part of the secret of the success of Benjamin Netanyahu. He's remained in power because the diplomatic process just hasn't been viable. There just hasn't been there, at least in the eyes of the Israeli voter, a viable option or a partner to deal with. And so in many ways, a lot of times, you know, the Palestinians who, you know, have come to a standstill with Israel as far as peace negotiations are concerned, have sort of nullified the left because they haven't had anything else to offer. So Netanyahu is kind of, at least politically speaking, has benefited from this vacuum. And he's saying, well, you know, in the absence of any kind of agreement or a chance for peace, I'm going to offer you strength and national and pride and all those other things that we know from elsewhere in the world. But really, I guess in some ways, which is ironic for those of us who have been following this for so long and know the history of politics in Israel, the Palestinian issue, peace, is really just not on the agenda this time. It's really mostly about referendum, about Netanyahu, pro or against. And even the issues which people are attacking him on really have very little to do with that. It mostly has to do with corruption. It mostly has to do with just sort of him being in office for so long and this, you know, inkling for a change. And even those calling for a change, very few voices in the Israeli political system are openly advocating for saying, let's make peace with the Palestinian, because it just has been pushed down lower on the national agenda.
And Aaron Heller, we're going to have to leave it there for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Daniel Estrin, Emmanuel Navon, Aaron Heller, and Dan Arbell for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Seth Bodine, Lara Cumming, and Michelle Stoddart. Edom Kassaye is our supervising producer, and Grace Lett is visual editor. Aaron Hay is audio engineer. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.